Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to this podcast, which is an abridged version of the television interview that I did with Jimmy Carr as part of my In Conversation series for W.
This podcast is brought to you by UKTV Play, the free on-demand service.
Tonight, I'm going to be in conversation with an award-winning television presenter and comedian whose comedy has been known to push the boundaries and split audiences. His financial affairs have also made the headlines, even being debated in the House of Commons. Tonight, I'm going to be in conversation with Jimmy Carr.
Thanks for doing this.
I would say lovely to be here. This is going to be great when it's finished, I would imagine.
You know what? I wanted something like this, something nice and warm and intimate, because most of the time, as you know, when you do a kind of interview show, you're either on a couch or you're separated. So that's where the whole faux brickwork came in.
It's like a classic comedy club look.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing. It's always kind of the brick wall behind just the microphone. That's always the very kind of scaled back.
Exactly. And for the guests that we've got on, for some, that's not the world that they live in. But for you, of all the guests that we've had on, even the comedians, you are someone who spent most of his life in comedy clubs. When I say most of his life, you spent more of your life by choice in comedy clubs than anywhere else.
Yeah, I did kind of. I feel like we have a similar kind of trajectory. We both came to it a little bit late.
Yeah.
And then it felt like, oh, we found this great thing. And then it was like the enthusiasm for it. I think a lot of people, when they find what they want to do very early, they can't help but take it for granted.
Your style of comedy and your approach to comedy was something that, before I got to know you as well as I do now, I always thought, OK, you do the comedy so that you can host television shows. Because your career on television has been so prolific and came so fast. It came like 3 years after you started. Everyone, I think, could be excused for saying that's what he does as a job, and the comedy's a side thing. People within the industry, you are known as the hardest working comedian. You do over 200 dates a year, and that's why I say your commitment's
the hardest working man in comedy. It's a bit, come on.
It's
that's like Britain's tallest dwarf. It's not really it's not really a thing. It's like, I mean, come on, you know how lazy everyone else is.
Maybe I'm phrasing this wrong. I think,
well, I know what you mean. I mean, comedy came first, and then everything else is gravy. So I think people, like the perception of people when they look at you, when you get interviewed by people that aren't comics, they go, oh, you're a TV host, or you also do stand-up. And you go, no, I do stand-up, and then other stuff happens, and that's lovely. But all of that's decided by someone else. The great thing about stand-up is you plant your own garden. You write a show, and you book a room, and people come, and you find your audience, and then that's that. You're kind of self-sustaining. Whereas with TV, it's a group, you know, effort. It's a team sport.
Yeah.
Whereas you can just be on your own on stage and you know, you can just do your own thing. It's sort of lovely.
But with stand-up, most stand-ups want to be liked. Most stand-ups do so that they be liked, so that they are liked. Whereas your stand-up is a stand-up that pushes it. I mean, you do this thing when you do tours where you go, right, I'm going to build up now to the most offensive joke of the night. So you are prepared to push the boundaries.
But it's still about being liked. I mean, I think every comedy show is about the same thing. It's every comedy show should be called Please Like Me.
Yeah, I'm desperate. There is a little thing.
Yeah.
Some of the titles of your shows, Barefaced Ambition and so on, is like, I'm ambitious, but please like me. I do want to be liked.
Well, it is that thing, though, where you... I mean, my favourite quote about laughter is that thing I often say, it's laughter is the shortest distance between two people. And the idea that when you laugh together, it's remote tickling is what it is. You're kind of grooming each other, for want of a better term, in this day and age. you're making someone, and especially with men, I think men are very bad at communicating emotionally. And jokes, essentially, it's a way of saying I like you and I want you to like me too. So you tell a little joke and you share a little moment. And I think doing that with the audience, I think the reason I've pushed the envelope or done sort of controversial jokes isn't sort of, I didn't sit down when I started doing comedy going, right, I'm going to be like a one-liner comedian and tell quite brutal jokes. That's my sense of humour. That's the stuff that really makes me laugh. And then it's that thing of wanting to share that with other people and wanting them to laugh. And then you find people with the same sense of humour as you. There's a lovely moment when you're on stage in sort of a 2,000-seater where you go, right, everyone in here has sort of got the same sense of humour. Yeah. We'd all be mates if we went to the same school or went to the same, worked in the same place. We'd all be friends because we'd all laugh together. That would be the little click. It's a lovely kind of, it's quite a nice thing. It's a real sense of, I think that's why people want to come out to see comedy, because they spend their lives a little bit alienated and looking at screens. And then when you come out to see a comedy show, or when you come out to see a TV record, you're sitting in a room and you're laughing together and you feel part of a group. It's a lovely, it's a very warm, kind of communal, tribal feeling.
For me, though, when you're talking about that communal sharing of a sense of humour, it is great when you're on tour and people have bought a ticket for you. Hmm. But as you know yourself, when you start out and you're finding your audience and you're turning up and you're a name on a bill, there's always a chance that you are going to say something that alienates half the room as well. So that's where the bravery, I think, in that style of comedy comes into it, because you've got to be prepared.
Yeah.
To lose as many of the audiences you win over.
Well, I suppose it's that thing of the go. I like to think of it, I write the show and the audience edit the show. And audiences are remarkably consistent. I often quote the Lenny Bruce thing, the audience is a genius. Some notable exceptions in here, I'm sure. But the audience is a genius. The audience decide what is and what isn't funny, and they decide what is and what isn't acceptable. And if you can come up with a joke, if it's something very controversial, something very taboo, that joke needs to be so good to justify being there. You know, so if you do a joke and it's observational stuff about everyday life and, you know, you can never find odd socks, whatever that thing is, yeah, that's not going to offend anyone, then it become, that's a lovely kind of warm comedy that everyone can relate to. If you're going to tell jokes about something really taboo, you know, then it's got to be good to justify being there, because otherwise it's just going to
upset people. No, I totally agree with you. In your shows, you find people guiltily laughing.
Yeah, off. It is that kind of, I suppose, if you want to be all clever about it, it's cognitive dissonance. Mm. It's that idea of having two thoughts in your head at the same time. And your sense of humour is more of a part of you, I think, than your conscience. Because you laugh straight away. It's like a reflex. You don't choose what you laugh at. I think there's a lot of people that would like to laugh at, you know, I don't know, Private Eye, kind of highfalutin satire.
Yeah.
They would go, well, that'd be a great thing to find funny. And actually, they like, you know, Benny Hill.
A fart that, jokes,
and yeah. that's what really makes them laugh. Yeah. And it's like a reflex. You laugh at it. And then my favourite noise in comedy is when people laugh and then there's a... what have I done? And it's a little bit guilty, and it's fun, and it's kind of pushing that... I don't know what it kind of tickles, but there's a... It scratches an itch. It's a really lovely kind of feeling. And it's also that feeling of intent being important, and people get that.
Yeah, absolutely. For you, the joy, the love of comedy has ever been understood by people, because you don't come across as a comedy anorak, you come across as somebody who's just intelligent, who can do it and is quite flippant with your audience. And you're not like that at all. You are
pretty into it.
What was the turning point? What was the thing that actually got you into comedy? You know, as a child, were you a funny kid?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the thing that got me... My mother was incredibly funny. Yeah. She was, like, properly, properly funny. And, like, not with jokes. She just had funny bones. She was just always kind of the life and soul. And it's a very attractive kind of quality. And you're close to someone and you kind of see that people kind of gravitate towards them. So there was a very high, I suppose, worth put on comedy in our house, on being funny, on being able to take a joke and being able to be funny with people. And so, but I kind of assumed growing up comedy was kind of that was your ante for being friends. That was well, if you couldn't make them laugh, then I guess hang out with someone else.
But also you're in a house of three boys.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's always, you know, we've got three boys in our house. There's always a battle among sons, because boys are boys, aren't they? There's a rough and tumble. So humour is a great icebreaker amongst the lads. Was it the same in your house?
I don't think as much, no. I don't think so. It was much more... my mother was kind of very much the a matriarch within the family, and she was really funny and sort of drew a lot of people in. So, I mean, a lot of my childhood friends were very close to my mum, would, like, spend time... Like, you'd sort of come home from university and they'd be at your house having tea with your mum. What are you doing? Having a chat. Chilling out.
And was your dad funny? Was it always your mum who carried the
humour? My mum was kind of she really had a larger than life. It's a weird thing. I mean, I suppose, you know, you always kind of, you know, put people on a pedestal, I guess. But no, she was genuinely brilliantly funny. If you ever said anything nice to her, this is like in microcosm, if you said, oh, you look nice, she'd go, I look like a whore at a christening. Right, all right.
I've never seen a whore at a christening.
I never... I never had any perception in my life that swearing was bad. Because yeah. she would... I mean, she would openly use the C word with teachers at the gate. She also had narcolepsy, so... But she didn't have sleep narcolepsy. She, when she laughed, she would lose kind of control. She'd lose kind of muscular control. So if you made her laugh, she wouldn't make any noise at all. I mean, I've got a ridiculous laugh, I can talk.
Yeah.
But she would properly, if you made her laugh, like properly laugh, she would kind of just kind of collapse.
I've had audience members like
and
that.
She, like, yeah, that's a different thing. You've got to cut down the length of those stories. But she'd properly collapse. So it was like the most joyful thing was if you could make her laugh, she would just go, stop, and then collapse. It was just, it was kind of lovely.
Because that was something that I read as well about you, which really quite surprised me, is that your mum and dad were Irish. They were Irish immigrants that came.
Yeah, I've got an Irish passport. I'm Irish, essentially.
I know, because you are probably the least Irish-looking person that I know. And I don't even know what I mean by that.
Come on, that's the potato with hair.
I know. but I don't know whether it's your accent or my assumption of your background based on your accents and the fact that you went to
Cambridge.
My
line on it was always the, you know, a plastic paddy is what I am.
Yeah.
You know, because Irish parents, Irish passport, but I speak and present myself in this way because I was raised and educated in the home counties. Goes to show what you can do when you apply yourselves. which doesn't go down brilliantly in Dublin, but it's worth a shot.
So your mum and dad came over together?
Early 70s, yeah.
Yeah, but they were married when they came over. You were born here. Yeah.
Born in, yeah, West London, yeah.
Yeah. And you spent summers over in Ireland.
Yeah, so kind of spent 6 weeks there. And always felt a little bit other, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because you sort of, you were very aware that your mum didn't sound like everyone else's mum at school. And you were kind of, you know, an immigrant family and living in Slough. So you were kind of aware of being a little bit different, which made you feel quite special as a kid.
Yeah.
It was quite nice.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to ask, actually. If you were spending your summers in Ireland and being English...
Yeah,
but being perceived almost Irish whilst you were in England, did you? Because
well,
what
you go
find...
back to Ireland and you'd go, everyone in Ireland would go, oh, the two English brothers, and then you go back to London and we'll go, oh, you sound Irish.
Yeah,
well, I mean, we must fit in somewhere.
But that's what you find.
You live on the ferry.
But that's what you find, isn't it, with comedians? There's always there has been a little bit in the life where they've been an outsider of a group. You know.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, actually, the psychology of laughter, and there's... Obviously, it's very pleasing to sort of the tears of a clown kind of cliche. I don't really see that much, but I do see a lot of comedians. If I had to make a guess about a comedian, they've normally got someone they were very close to as a child that they had to make laugh.
Yeah.
Whether it was someone that was sick or someone that was depressed, but they had a family member that they... Making them laugh was a very important part of their life. That tends to be something that... That I think a lot of comedians can kind of relate to.
Yeah, for you, it was your mum.
Yeah.
But your mum sadly died, really, before she saw you make this a profession.
Well, she got to see me leave my job.
Yeah.
Which was, I think, what she wanted. I think she really kind of liked that, the idea of just going, yeah, I'm leaving. Don't worry about it. I'll be fine. I'll think of something.
Did you talk to her much about it?
Not much. I mean, I think she kind of thought it was... She had a very sort of bizarre idea of kind of... I said, I think I might want to try doing comedy. She went, yeah, you should be on telly. Oh, right, OK, I'll do that then.
I'll phone up the telly and say...
I'll phone up the telly and say, can I be on?
Oh, come on.
Well, she was fucking right. I mean, she was 100% right, but somehow, organically, she just kind of went, yeah, you should be on telly, yeah, fine, yeah, do that. Yeah, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. It'll work out. I think it was that thing of, like, that she really liked the idea of, I think, taking a chance and, you know, running off and joining the circus. I'm sure there's some Romany blood in there somewhere. Yeah. The idea of just go, well, yeah, go and do it, it'll be fine. And I think actually up to that point, I'd sort of done what was very much expected. And so to leave and just to go, all right, I'm not going to do any of that anymore, was really kind of freeing.
When you then faced all that controversy with the taxation and David Cameron quoting you, and it seemed to me quite apparent that people attacked your persona because they just thought, well, we don't know anything about him. He tells jokes, so let's just have a go at him as a person.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, that, because I think a lot of people assumed I wouldn't care.
Yeah, that's
that,
what
like,
I mean.
A lot
yeah.
of people just went, oh, he'll be fine, he won't care about that. And it was really kind of... It's a weird thing to go through when you're on the cover of the paper. You really find out who your friends are.
Yeah.
You really... I mean, I remember you on the day tweeting a very supportive thing and kind of going, all right, OK. But you remember all of them. You remember the people that didn't call, the people that did call. You remember, you know, the people that go, I mean, I made a mistake, clearly, and I paid it all. But you kind of go, well, that's sort of too little too late for a lot of people that kind of made up their mind about you. But it's quite an interesting thing to go through. And it's surprising, actually, because your persona is so kind of brutal. They assume you'll just
go, You could take it. Yeah. And that's what struck me about it. And for clarity, for people who are not familiar, you were part amongst a number, thousands of investors in a scheme called K2, which was not illegal, but then was deemed to
immoral.
Be immoral.
So it was tax... it wasn't tax evasion, it was tax avoidance.
Yeah.
Of which, I mean, it would appear now when the subsequently, everyone you've ever heard of, everyone in sport, everyone in entertainment, has done something to mitigate their tax bill. But I was doing it quite aggressively through just, I suppose, a lack of judgment, but also not really thinking about it. You know, the accountant calls you and goes, do you want to pay less tax?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good. That sounds excellent. OK, what do we have to do? Well, nothing. You don't have to do anything. Just sign a thing.
Sign a thing and we'll do it. Yeah.
And then you go, well, fine, OK, I'll give that a crack.
But why was it you that became singled out? That's what I was trying to get to. Because you had this persona of being a hard person, do you think that was why they went, well, there's a whole list of names. I'll tell you what, let's just focus on Jimmy Carr.
I don't know. I suppose I think it's maybe just, you know, those are the way that the cards fell. I don't think there was any malice in it.
Yeah.
And I think the world's changed fundamentally since that happened. I think no one's doing that anymore.
No.
No one's kind of doing anything like that anymore. No, people just, you know, so I think it was a scandal that needed to happen, and I happened to be the face of it. It's not, you know.
But the face of it on a completely different level. I mean, people
who... Gary Barlow was the same week.
Yeah.
And no one... It was a different
thing. That's
what
I was going to say. I mean, Gary Barlow...
He's quite beloved. He's a national treasure.
But to me, that's what I was looking at. You know, Gary Barlow didn't receive the comments from the Prime Minister, wasn't debated in the Houses of Parliament. I mean...
I didn't write back for good.
Yeah.
Well, you've got to remember.
To be fair, David Cameron may have made love to the sound of Gary Barlow. Yeah. I don't think he has to your jokes, but that might have had something to do with it. So yeah, but that's what I mean. Was the bit where you?
Isn't there a thing? I mean, while we're on the topic of this, I don't think anyone for a second, any footballer that's ever done anything like I've done, and most of them have, it would appear, no one blames the footballer.
No.
Everyone goes, yeah, of course. Their financial guy did that. What does Wayne Rooney know?
Yeah, exactly.
He's probably just signed a thing, he's fine. He's probably an idiot. And a lot of them are very bright. I know a bunch of footballers, you know, a lot of them very bright, some of them not so much. But you assume that they didn't know what they were doing. Whereas I think with me, you assume, he probably came up with a scheme.
He went to Cambridge. Yeah, exactly.
No fucking clue.
That's what
literally, I will sign anything.
He went to Cambridge, he speaks with a posh voice, he's obviously intelligent. As you say, he probably came up with the scheme. And that was the thing that struck me about it, is that, you know, you then used your profession because you dealt with heckles about it and you managed it. But you never, from what I can see, sought to deflect the blame and went, oh, hang on, it's not just me. What about him? You just went, OK, if there's a punching bag, I'll accept it.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, but you did something that was, you know, morally very questionable, and you kind of go, well, OK.
Yeah.
You know, and you just have to man up, you know, go on tour, pay it all back.
Yeah. Which, to be fair, you've done. There's no question about that. But what did you learn about you as a person through that?
Well, you think you're going to be nails hard. You know, you think you're going to be fine because everything, you're floating along, everything's great. Suddenly you're on the front page of the paper and you're kind of, you suddenly have this thing. It makes you very grateful for what you've got. Mm. And then it makes me more grateful now that I've still got it because there's a chance. You know, David Cameron was at the G20 conference, came out and did a press conference. We just talked about me and my personal tax affairs, which you're not really meant to do as the Prime Minister. But looking at it now, I've still got my job.
I would have said, and
I've never fucked a pig, but that's not... not strictly speaking true.
This podcast is sponsored by UK TV Play, the free on-demand service, where you can watch the TV shows you love from Dave, Yesterday, Really, and Drama, wherever you want, whenever you want. The home of BAFTA-nominated series Taskmaster and the critically acclaimed Red Dwarf, alongside other UK TV Play exclusive, including The White Princess and Most Haunted. UK TV Play offers free access to thousands of hours of comedy, drama, documentaries, and paranormal TV, all for free.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
At the time, as I say, you became this focus for loads of media attention, and it became a byword, and it's all cleared and so on. But you're also, your partner Caroline was put under, your whole life was put under the spotlight.
Yeah.
How important was it having somebody like her next to you who understood the world? Because that's often when show business, if their partner doesn't understand it, that's difficult.
No, I think it's that thing where you go, I've got people around me that I'm very close to that just went, you're going to be okay. You're going to be able to handle this. But you really do find out. I mean, it's kind of horrible because you find out who your friends are and you value that more than you can say. I mean, you'll never forget the people that kind of reached out around that time. But then you also find out the people that are kind of gleefully, oh, he got brought down a peg or two. Good. Mm. Oh, all right.
Yeah. I've got to ask you this. The way you met Caroline, because she worked in the industry and she was a producer, you went for a job, and I heard you tell this story.
Well, I mean, I'll tell it again. I like it.
Don't like it as much as I like it.
Well, I went for an audition for something. She was working at a TV company, and there was an idea for a panel show, and I was quite new in comedy. And she'd come to see me. She'd come to see me at the Comedy Cafe, and she knew some of the Canadian comedians because she's Canadian, and she'd come to see me or whatever. And I had a terrible set. I mean, really not great. And then I went in for like a meeting with her. So I was aware that she'd been to see the show, and then she had a meeting with her. And I'm not like a romantic in any way. I mean, I'm not. And I just knew. I just thought she's amazing. And then she had to write notes on me, and she did not feel the same. She wrote, "He is a one-note comedian with the eyes of a rapist." This is the woman I love, by the way. This is not someone that dislikes me now. But she just went, don't get it at all. And then I just sort of, I suppose you would call it stalking in this day and age, but that went very well.
How do you win someone over if that's their first impression?
I kind of just knew. I remember calling Hannah sort of straight after the meeting going, I can't work with her. She's lovely, but I can't think when she's around. She was, I just kind of knew.
Yeah.
She was kind of great. But then, I mean, we've still got the little bit of paper, the little... OK.
Does it come out every time there's an argument? I was right!
Yeah.
She's... But she's obviously been involved in the industry, and you mentioned that she was from Canada, because that's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, is that your step into North America. You spent a lot of time, probably more than any of the other British comedians that I know in recent years, going backwards and forwards and building a presence in America. What is it that draws you there?
Well, I suppose it's that thing of, OK, I'm very aware and very grateful to have the best job for me. I'm a comedian, it's brilliant. But what keeps that fresh? 15, 16 years into being a comedian, what keeps you, excited about this job? Because everything gets routine. Walking on stage gets to be a routine. You're less nervous than you used to be. It's kind of nice to be nervous. And it's nice to have that feeling walking out and going, well, I'm not preaching to the choir here.
Yeah.
These are new converts. Half of them don't know who I am. Let's try and make this work. So touring the world. So last year I did 34 countries. So it's not just North America. I mean, I did everywhere. And it just makes it feel fresh again. It just makes it feel new. It's exciting. You're traveling the world telling jokes. It's like the perfect job.
But how do you balance that with your home life, having a relationship, trying
to
keep
everything going? We haven't got kids, so there's that. You know, it's much easier for me to travel than I think. Mm. You know, you've got three kids to look after, and you've got to be around for that kind of stuff. So you can travel a great deal, and a very understanding partner. But also, she gets to come on lots of the trips. If I go somewhere interesting, she'll come.
Yeah, because that's what I was saying. Like, she's in the industry, so she's got an interest in it.
Yeah.
Would it change all that if you had kids?
I think so, yeah. I think you'd want to be there.
Yeah.
You'd want to be kind of present. But, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. It might be a reason to go.
Yeah. Honestly. Who did that? I know one comedian when he had two kids and then his wife was giving birth to his third, and he, mentioning those, he put a tour in.
Oh.
He put a tour in. It just on the basis that I need some lions. The first 6 weeks is going to be terrible. I'm going to be on the road. Oh, so suddenly the Travelodge in Swindon looked like, oh, brilliant.
I've got to ask you this as well. It comes back to what we were talking about before in terms of jokes and pushing the envelope. Do you ever worry that you're going to upset people? And I say this specifically because you have made a few jokes where there are people involved.
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I suppose my line on it is always, you know, I'm telling jokes to an audience that have bought into me, that have paid to be there in the theatre.
Yeah.
I'm not shouting them through people's letterboxes. is kind of the defence, is going, you're not kind of pushing your jokes onto other people, but then, you know, they appear on TV, and when press report on it, sometimes you can worry, you know, freedom of speech doesn't mean it's free of consequence.
Yeah.
You know, so you want to be free to say whatever you want, but there's going to be consequences if you say certain things, and when it's taken out of context, it does upset me that you go, well, that joke, you didn't report a joke in the paper because you took away the timing and you took away the laughter and you just used, and it was written down on the page in the Daily Mail. It's quite a brutal line.
Yeah.
And then you phoned up, you know, a bereaved parent and said, do you think this is funny? No, of course they didn't think it was funny. But, you know, it was within that context it really worked.
Yeah.
And then you took it out of that and you... So you do worry about... I mean, you know, you'd have to be fairly heartless to sort of go, well, I don't care what anyone thinks. But then I do see the joy in an audience in laughing at things. I do see that, I think, net-net, you make the world a slightly better place being a comedian.
Yeah.
Because people release endorphins and they feel good and they laugh.
But is there any area where you go, because I know you've done stuff, which is quite... a lot of comedians were doing stuff because it was such a big news event, things like Diana and so on, but then you still got asked to do the Royal Variety Show. So someone's obviously gone, that was a joke, we can accept it as a joke and still invited to do the Royal Variety.
Maybe they didn't know.
Maybe they didn't know.
Maybe the research isn't what it could be.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose that thing where you go, I've told so many jokes as well because of the volume of material that I do in a show. There might be 200 jokes in a show. I think partly you get away with more because of the volume that you do, because they get that it's just another joke. And that story that ran, I mean, it still runs maybe once every 6 months, maybe once a year now, not as often, of like comedian tells joke. That's the newspaper story. Comedian tells joke. Here it is out of context. We found two people to be offended. All right.
Yeah.
Well, I played to 500,000 people on that tour, so if two people were offended, I reckon those are pretty good odds.
Yeah.
I'll take that.
Every time we have people on the show, we ask them to bring a photograph on that's important to them or means something to them. This is the picture that you've brought.
I'm on the left. That's me on the left, and I've put on a lot of weight since then.
That's your mum?
Yeah, that's me and my mum.
What made you pick that picture?
I don't know, literally, you kind of asked, and I never look through... I don't look back a lot. I'm not one of those... I'm not sentimental. Or maybe I'm too sentimental. I find it quite painful. So I very rarely look back. But I sort of opened an old photo album today and saw that and just thought, oh, it's really nice. It's kind of how I remember her looking. And then just thought it was a nice thing. And I think a lot of my sense of humour, a lot of my life is from that.
From your mum?
Yeah, she was just so fun.
Not your dad? Your dad had no influence on your personality?
Not my... Well, I mean, I'm sure an influence, but, you know, there's plenty of negative aspects. But that was a joyful part of my life.
Yeah. Because I suppose that thing about having someone that you said in your family that you wanted to make laugh...
You wanted to make everything OK, and I suppose that's the sound of laughter, isn't it? You sort of... I associate it with everything being OK.
Yeah.
Everything. So any tension in the house, any kind of... aggression or people feeling kind of on edge, was taken away with laughter. And so whether it was her being funny or me being funny or making each other laugh and making everything okay was a very joyful thing. And then that to become your job is a dream come true.
Yeah. And so without your mum, do you think you would have been a comedian?
No, I don't think so. I don't think you would have... No, I don't think.
You don't think you would... I suppose from what you're saying there, if it breaks tension in the house or it removes...
And maybe that's why I'm drawn to that darker side, because when you talk about those issues, you know, we talked about the stuff you can't joke about, the stuff you can joke about, the stuff that's very taboo and edgy and I can do on stage at a tour show. It is about, it's a fast route. When you mention one of those topics, it's a fast route to tension. Mm. As soon as you mention, you know, if you mention immigration, suddenly an audience go, oh, what's he going to say? And then it's not anything offensive, it's not anything with an agenda, but it's like the release of that is such a wonderful moment of that tension's gone. And then the next setup builds up more tension and then you release again. And it's almost a microcosm of that first great experience with laughter of being at home and there being tension and then people laughing and being okay.
But where was it? Was the tension just in the house?
Yeah, there was a bit of tension in the house. You know, growing up, it was a bit, you know.
So you clearly don't want to talk about it.
I think that's it's a difficult thing to talk about. It's not like it was a tough upbringing. I had a very easy life compared to what most people have, but there was a lot of tension, and actually my mum being funny made everything okay.
And I don't want to dive into it. It's just that thing that you the way you described needing the tension to make the humour work almost.
Yeah.
That's why I was interested in it, because if you're existing in a house where there was tension and your mum and dad did split up and so on, so there's obviously that doesn't happen without there being tension on the way. If you've experienced the joy of laughter within that vortex, then that's presumably what you move towards when you're trying to create that same feeling.
Yeah, I suppose. And you're kind of chasing that high, I suppose.
Yeah.
Chasing that kind of that release and that lovely feeling of laughter and everything's kind of okay. You know, life can be like that. Life can be, you know, it's not all, you know, sweetness and light. But I suppose in a way, what you do on stage as well, the stakes, you raise the stakes in a different way, because instead of mentioning a taboo topic, you sort of let people into your life and you sort of, you feel a bit drawn in and you sort of mention Mel and you mention the kids and then you suddenly know, you know, the search history on the computer or whatever, there's a huge tension. You kind of let people into your life and they go, I know.
It is, and at times, to be honest with you, when I'm doing it, at times I'm thinking, I don't know these people. Why am I talking like this?
Yeah.
Why am I mentioning my wife's name? Why am I saying that? But I'm a bit like you. I don't know another way to do it.
It doesn't
feel right any other way. And with you, I can see with you, particularly when you refer to your mum, and that's the way that you created joy, by needing to have something to break, a bubble to burst almost.
Yeah.
The difference, I guess, is that I was lucky enough that my mum and dad are still here, so with the journey that I've gone on, they've shared and they've seen.
Yeah, that'd be a nice thing.
Yeah.
That thing of the you know, making someone proud. But I don't think you ever lose that. You have people in your life that maybe fill that void a little bit.
Mm.
I mean, you don't specifically think about it, but I don't think anyone ever... I think you'd be crazy if you kind of go through life and you don't have father figures or you don't have mother figures kind of within your life that you want to kind of impress and kind of, I did this, what do you think?
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, it becomes friends and it becomes, you know... You become drawn to certain people that have got that kind of attribute.
But that one person who's gone, and for you, as a child, you were brought up as a Catholic, so you were brought up with a faith, you were brought up with an idea that there would be... the spirituality would still be there. When you lost your mum, did you go, well, that's it, it's not there? Or is there something within you now that kind of feels she does see all
really,
this?
Really annoyingly, I lost my faith about 18 months before she died. So, I mean, I'm an atheist. And I really miss it.
Yeah.
I really miss that kind of... People never really talk about that, but the certainty of faith, it's a really nice thing to have faith. I'm quite jealous of people that believe. I mean, I don't, I just... You know, the way I talk about it, I used to, when I was a kid, I had an imaginary friend. I used to talk to him. I used to think he could hear me and he could grant me wishes. And then I grew up and I stopped going to church.
Yeah.
And it's a sad joke for me in a way, because you kind of go, oh, right, it was good that.
Well, what was the bit that made you lose faith? Because you were quite specific then, saying it was about 18 months
ago. Yeah, it was a gradual thing. I mean, it didn't happen like in a day, but it was like a gradual thing of going, well, if I'm right about this, if Catholicism is correct, everything else is bullshit.
Mm.
And I couldn't live with that. I couldn't say that, oh, well, that's nonsense. Oh, that's nonsense. And that's that faith. Oh, these guys, crazy.
Yeah.
And the idea of going, oh, maybe we're all right. It seemed much more plausible. You know what? Maybe we're all wrong.
Yeah.
And then you start to read more about it, and it's kind of it just fell apart.
But to lose it and then lose your mum, because as you say, there's a reassurance if you've got faith, because you could go, well, it's okay. My mum's here in spirit, or she can see it, or. You know, that gift that she gave you.
Yeah, but maybe on. You know, maybe the. I mean, not to be. I'm not a spiritual kind of guy, but that idea of going, well, if she gave me the gift of laughter, and then that's what I do with my life, then that's enough.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, if she lives in that, that'll have to do. Yeah. I don't think anyone's looking down.
Yeah, but you know, it's not a bad that'll have to do, is it?
Yeah, it's not terrible.
No. Ladies and gentlemen, I think you'll all agree. It's been a wonderful conversation, Jimmy Carr.
This podcast was brought to you by UK TV Play, the free on-demand service.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.